Well, as promised, we are going to review Richard Osman's book, The Thursday Murder Club, with our panel, Alice Goulding, Felicity Radcliffe and Jean Fairbairn. But before we do that, oh, good evening, ladies, first of all.
Good evening.
Good evening.
First of all, I'm going to review or read a review from The Guardian about the book, and then we'll chat to the ladies to see what they felt about it. The novel has become the fastest selling adult crime debut since records began. That's quite an achievement for what turns out to be an amiable, if undemanding, cosy caper. What marks it out is the originality of the setting, inspired by a visit Osmond paid to an affluent retirement village, boasting a full range of recreational and medical facilities, including a contemporary upscale restaurant. In the novel, this becomes Cooper's Chase, an exclusive development secreted on the Kentish Weald. You can't move here until you're over 65 and the Waitrose delivery vans clink with wine and repeat prescriptions every time they pass over the cattle grid. Every Thursday, the amateur sleuths of Cooper's Chase gather in the jigsaw room between art history and conversational French to investigate unsolved murder cases that the Kent Police Force have been too incompetent to prosecute themselves. Cooper's Chase sits on the site of a former convent. Now the developer, a brash vulgarian who owns a red grand piano, is exploiting a contractual loophole to turn the chapel and graveyard into 8 new flats. Clearly, he is not long for this world, and when somebody slips him a lethal injection in a scuffle, the Thursday Murder Club have a real-life homicide on their hands. Osman's plotting is both deft and daft in equal measure, and the key members of the over-60s murder squad are distinctly drawn. Elizabeth, the prime mover, was the sort of teacher who terrifies you all year, then gets you a grade A and cries when you leave. Her sidekicks include militant Red Ron Ritchie, who has a West Ham tattoo on his neck and vociferous opinions to match, the former nurse Joyce, the quiet one in a lavender blouse and mauve cardigan, who goes unnoticed but notices everything. Only the fastidious Egyptian psychiatrist Ibrahim feels like a bit of a cipher, including to introduce a hint of diversity. And of course, there are loose ends left dangling. The Thursday Murder Club is set to run and run. So that was the review in The Guardian. So let's start off with Alice.
I actually quite enjoyed it. It did take a little while to get into it. I think there is a very, very large cast of characters, so that could get a little bit confusing. And I found that I was skipping backwards and forwards a little bit, trying to work out who was who, especially when there was similar names like Gordon and Jerry. You know, I got a little bit confused with those. I thought the quote at the beginning was fun. That sort of caught your attention, put you straight in. Quote, it was, "Killing someone is easy. Hiding the body, now that's usually the hard part. That's how you get caught." Wow. So I thought that was quite clever. I like that. And I think there was a lot of humour in it. I thought there was some lovely little bits. They were talking about tablets and then they had to explain in the newsletter that it meant computers. I thought that was quite sweet because the setting of the retirement home, I mean, it was brilliant. I want to retire there. I just thought it was absolutely fantastic. Oh, yes, the other thing was the knitters and the natters. Members becoming disillusioned because there was too much nattering and not enough knitting. That was quite funny as well. Yeah, the second, what was it? The second bottle of red wine, and it's only 12:15. I thought that was just wonderful. That's definitely my sort of retirement home. So yes, it was very funny in places. The main characters were quite nicely drawn, but I just felt there was slightly too many characters. It did get a little bit confusing with all of them. And then they started introducing more characters towards the end when you just thought you were coming to the end of the plot, and it sort of extended the story a little bit more. So I wasn't quite sure about that. I thought that was cheating a little bit myself. And it rambled a little bit to start with, but I think because it was in the character of Joyce, and Joyce is the sort of character that rambles, so that actually made sense to me. So yes, I mean, I did enjoy it. I thought it was a good read and it was quite fun. And I can see that it will be popular with people. I think people will buy it and want to read more of them.
Would you read a sequel?
Personally, probably not. But I've got a sneaking suspicion that other people definitely would.
I found it difficult to get into. Then I got into it and then I got bored with it. I thought there were some very, very humorous lines, one-liners I thought were very good. And I should have made a note of them, but I didn't. But yeah, there were some very good one-liners in there. But I must admit, I didn't finish it. I just got bored with it and I didn't finish it.
Oh.
So let's go to Jean now.
I found it extraordinarily long, extraordinarily funny. I mean, we had the bit where Donna said, they were talking about security, and she said, oh, I'd welcome a burglar. It would be nice to have a visitor. I mean, hell's bells, that was funny.
Yes.
There was a lot of bathos, or bathos if you call it that. There'd been the briefest of lulls and a tonal symphony of whistles began as some hearing aids were turned up, while others were switched off. It was extraordinarily funny. I wondered why it was, how many pages? 373 pages long.
You thought it was too long, did you?
A bit too long, and there was that part two. Well, I hardly got to part one.
Really?
And at the end, of course. I did like some of the chapters were only one page long, weren't they?
Yes, they were very short chapters. I wasn't sure if I liked that or not.
Well, that, I thought that's both Dickens' household words. Dickens used to publish his stuff monthly or even weekly.
Yes.
Very short chapters and masses of them. So I think it works quite well, actually, because you always knew where you were. And the print, as Alison pointed out to me, was quite large.
Hmm.
Not that I need large print. But I did. It was just full of, well, so these funny one-liners. I thought it was the funniest thing I'd read since Bryson. Him, yeah, he made
Bill Bryson.
Yeah, thank you. Notes from a Small Island.
Yes.
And I thought it was very much in the same vein, but I did wonder why it was so long. Perhaps I could ask him. it's a sort of first-person journal, it said, in one of the reviews. And then it slips into third-person. And Joyce is the main one. Very good idea. Yeah, just as you say, too long. And I'll shake the hand of anyone who gets to the end of it.
So, did you get to the end of it?
No.
Right, okay. It is very popular. So, obviously, you know, people have been reading it. And as it said in the review from The Guardian, the most popular debut book. Do you think it's because of his popularity on the television that people haven't bought it?
I just think it's funny.
It is funny.
And Stein,
you know, you have to wait for these one-liners to make you smile. I wasn't interested who killed who in the end. I just thought, oh, I can't be bothered with all of that.
I think stylistically it was very funny. I think obviously because he's on the TV, that's probably why people bought it originally.
Mm.
And then it was just a bonus that it was so funny.
Yeah.
But it was miles too long.
Yeah, but it wasn't funny enough for you to finish it to the end.
Well, no, that was just a time constraint.
Time constraint, okay.
That was just time constraint, giving myself too much to do and then whining about it.
All right. And what about Fliss? What did you think?
I enjoyed the first half. I enjoyed the situation. You know, it definitely felt as though he was going for heartwarming, if you like. And it was good to see older people being depicted in a really positive way and even being a bit rebellious, you know, with their sort of 12, 15 bottles of wine. Although you had to be a pretty affluent older person to be in Cooper's Chase. They obviously all had to be wealthy. And I deliberately didn't read any of the reviews, but I'd be surprised if a few people hadn't accused him of being elitist.
Yes.
Depicting well-off at older people.
Did you finish it to the end?
I did.
You did?
I did.
Jean didn't, I didn't.
So I enjoyed the first half. I agree that there was a lot of really good one-liners in it. However, I think he was going for breadth rather than depth.
Do you think?
As Alice said, there was a huge cast of characters and some of them were very sketchily drawn. I think even the major ones weren't done in particular detail. So it's quite difficult to keep track of them or care about them. I found Joyce a bit of a caricature personally, the sort of cardigan wearing
genial old lazy. I think someone used the word cipher. Was it the Guardian Review used the word cipher?
Yeah.
And I would agree with that. My problem was really as it continued and they kept throwing in more plot lines, more characters. I kind of written down here, I felt like towards the end, like I was in the Millennium Falcon flying through an asteroid belt and there was bits of like plot and new characters coming in at me and bouncing off my spaceship in all directions. I just got absolutely bamboozled by it towards the end and found that I really didn't care what the outcome was.
Yes,
who had done it. I actually think it would have been better if some of the central characters had actually been involved in the murder. That would have been quite interesting if some of your heartwarming older characters are really quite double-sided and were, but that didn't happen. He kind of made peripheral characters responsible, which I thought made it a bit weaker. And characters like Penny, who were in a coma right from the start, I couldn't get invested in them because they were just in that state the whole way through the book.
That actually did bring a tear to my eye when she was in the coma the whole time and her husband went every single day and sat there all day long. That did bring a tear to my eye. Did you think he described each character enough for us to get into each character?
Not really. I think they all had kind of labels, but I don't think they were drawn deeply enough for my personal taste. They were a bit shallow.
Did you find him patronising at all?
Not particularly, no. I didn't find the setting quite as unusual as The Guardian did. It was quite easy to imagine the sort of Waitrose vans clinking. Although when I last looked, I don't think Waitrose fans bring repeat prescriptions, but that might just be me.
Yeah.
So I thought there was just too much in there and not enough depth, too much breadth and not enough depth for my personal taste. Overall, I enjoyed it, particularly the first half, but I'm not sure it would have been done quite so well if it hadn't been written by a well-known and well-loved person.
Would you buy a sequel?
Like Alice, probably not, actually.
No, and Jean won't either, so...
I might, actually. He's talking about... He's thinking, Ian, about killing Tony Curran. And he said he realises it's a dangerous thing to do because he's put, like, a brick house. This morning he Googled stab-proof vests, but the same day delivery option wasn't available on Amazon Prime. They must think he's daft. Those gems... To me, are gems.
I agree with you, but you have to keep reading before you get to them.
This is it. It's like digging out. It's like being a coal miner digging out a nugget of gold.
Yes, exactly. And I don't think I've got time to do that. I've got other things to do.
I didn't either.
Okay, so that is the review of the Thursday Murder Club. So we'll go to a break now, and then we'll come back and discuss something else. Welcome back to Rodwell Smith for April's Book Club with our reviewers, Alice Goulding, Felicity Radcliffe and Jean Fairbairn. Now, in the first half, we did review Richard Osman's The Thursday Murder Club. So for May, ladies, Alice decided on the book for May. So can you tell us all about this, please, Alice?
It's called The Duke and I by Julia Quinn. And it's the first book in the Bridgerton series, which has just been made into a serial on Netflix. And it's a very, very funny book. I really, really enjoyed it. So I'm trying to convert you all into historical romances, probably unsuccessfully. But I just think it's a fantastic book. And I think Netflix have done an absolutely wonderful job in televising it.
So, remind us what the name of the book is again.
Okay, the book is called The Duke and I by Julia Quinn. And it's a historical romance. It's set in the Georgian times and very much of the vein of Georgette Heyer. So, for Georgette Heyer fans, they will love this book.
Georgette Heyer, yes. Not the sort of book that I would read. What about you, Fliss?
I like historical novels. I don't read that many of them. I haven't read Georgette Heyer. I have read Philippa Gregory's historical novels.
I think they're excellent. I've read a lot of hers.
Yeah, I mean, she's a bona fide historian, isn't she, and an academic. And I think the depth of her knowledge sort of comes through. But then she tells a great story as well. I like those, but I haven't read any Georgette Heyer, I'm afraid.
Okay. Jean, is this the sort of book you would normally read?
I grew up with Georgette Heyer and Nora Loft's. Fabulous. Love them.
So you're going to be... Have you read this book before?
No, but I've read almost every Georgette Heyer or I had when I was young.
So you are going to enjoy this then?
I would love it.
Good. Okay, so that will be for May. Okay, ladies. Now, we've got time left, so let's talk about the funeral that was on recently, the big funeral, the only one and only funeral. I saw it from beginning to end. I thought it was incredibly emotional. I thought it was incredibly tasteful. And it was Britain doing pageantry at its best. It was very emotional. I was fine until the Lone Piper played as he walked out of the chapel and the pipes just faded in the distance and then I lost it. Anyway, what did you think? First of all, Felicity.
I thought the image of the Queen sitting on her own in her face mask was incredibly poignant. You know, you couldn't help but feel for her. They'd been married for, 73 years, and there she was, tiny little figure sitting on her own. I found that very, very sad. I thought the music was amazing. Those four singers, the sound that they produced from just four people singing a cappella, I thought was
beautiful.
Astounding. I did enjoy that. And, yeah, the outdoor pageantry was very impressive, but I think, like they said in the press, I do suspect that he would have quite liked that pared back approach, you know, rather than 800 guests. I think he would probably have enjoyed the fact that his nearest and dearest were there, his family, his best friends, saying goodbye to him. I thought that was quite nice, albeit when he saw the pictures of St George's Chapel, I couldn't help comparing with what it was like when Harry and Meghan got married.
Yes.
And every seat was full. It felt like such a joyous place.
Yeah.
And then just seeing it, you know, so huge and cavernous and empty, you couldn't help but be marked by the contrast, really.
Well, what the pandemic did was, first of all, bring them together for a year where they were self-isolating at Windsor. So that must have been nice for the pair of them. It's very rare that they had time together because he spent a lot of time in Sandringham on his retirement. And then he wanted a pared-down funeral, which he got. Maybe more pared-down than he thought it would be, but came across as very personal and just brilliant. And he had orchestrated the whole lot, including the design of this Land Rover. What did you think, Jean?
I was surprised at how religious it was. I loved the Lone Piper at the end, which reminded me of my dad's funeral, because I want a Lone Piper. He played Flowers of the Forest, traditional lament. I was hoping he'd play the Gael, but he didn't. But anyway, enough of that. The Sailor's Whistles, I thought, was really eerie. It was fabulous. The trumpets at the end, all done with no vowels, just lips up and down.
Yeah.
Fabulous. The only thing I did was a bit iffy about, this sounds really arrogant, was Simon Armitage's poem, which I heard this morning. And I thought, there'll be opinions on that.
Yeah.
The music that he had commissioned, the special thing, I thought was terribly modern, which bound to upset a few people. But it was actually quite interesting. It was terribly tasteful and... Who couldn't feel sorry for the Queen?
Yeah.
Tiny little person.
Yes.
That was the tragic bit.
Yes, yeah. Alice didn't see it, so you can't really make a comment about it.
Yes, no, I'm sorry. I was one of the few people who didn't watch the funeral. So I can't really make any comments.
But what I remember, because I lost my husband 18 years ago, the day after his funeral, I remember waking up and thinking what day it was. And I thought, oh, it was Colin's funeral yesterday. And then I yelled out loud, I did it. And a big smile on my face. And the I did it was, I gave him a fantastic send-off and I held it together the whole day. I obviously lost it for many years afterwards. But I remember standing in front of the mirror and I thought, I've got him beside me. I've got my grandmother beside me. And I looked in the mirror and I just said, you're on, girl. You're on. And it was a performance, and it was a performance of holding everything together, making sure everybody was okay, making sure the funeral went absolutely perfectly, and it did. So it brought back lots of memories, I must say.
The Queen's a little bit like that, isn't she? She's a professional, so she does this sort of thing all the time, doesn't she? And she's very good at covering up the emotions and things, and gets criticised for it, which I think is not on, really.
The sort of sight of her walking back to the castle afterwards, I just hope someone was waiting with a large Dubonnet for her to just sit down and decompress after all of that.
It must be really hard work. Yeah, I'm sure. Certainly after something like that, you know, she's a widow of many, many hundreds of thousands of widows. You just want somebody to ring you every day just to say how you're doing, just to know that people are thinking of you. And you want to be on your own, but you don't want to be on your own. It's a very strange feeling. I was only married to my husband 12 years, but she's been married for 73 years. That person has gone from your life, and there is a huge void. Even if your marriage isn't that brilliant, it's still a void. That person is gone, because that person you wake up to every day morning and you go to bed with every night, and all of a sudden there's this big gap. It's something you have to get used to. Sleeping alone, you know, you have to get used to. But you do. As always, it's time. It's time. Bless her heart, that's all we can say. Bless her heart.
Is it common practice, do you think, to arrange your own funeral, the service, etc.? Because I have, because the thought of leaving my going away to my other half fills me with dread.
You do it yourself.
I have.
I did.
I've been ready for years.
Oh, you're far too young, Jean. You've got many, many years ahead of you yet.
Well, I don't know. I can't take chances on this sort of thing.
That's true. Okay, ladies. Well, thank you very much. So that is April's book club. We're going to review, as Alice said. Can you just repeat that, Alice, please?
It's called The Duke and I by Julia Quinn.
Right. Okay. So we'll be reviewing that. Hopefully I'll be able to finish that book by the time we come back at the end of May. Anyway, ladies, thank you very much indeed. Keep safe. Keep well, and I'll talk to you again soon.
Bye. Thank you, Sue.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye.
This is an article by Jake Kerridge from The Telegraph on the announcement of the death of the Duke of Edinburgh. When Prince Philip stepped down from official duties in 2017, it was announced that he would spend his retirement carriage driving and reading. The former was a given. But where the latter was concerned, one couldn't help wondering whether he was doomed to the same fate as Sir Robert Walpole, who picked up a book on his first day of retirement, burst into tears, and declared, "I have led a life of business so long that I have lost my taste for reading. And now, what shall I do?" In fact, the Duke made considerable inroads into his library at Wood Farm, his retirement bolt hole at Sandringham. Unlike Walpole, he had been wise enough never to stop cultivating the habit of reading, despite the grueling demands of his prolonged working life. And he managed to carve time out of his schedule, not only for reading, but for writing too. He published 14 books on subjects ranging from birds and conservation to religious philosophy and, yes, carriage driving. The Duke's literary and intellectual achievements have tended to be underrated. This is partly because his manner of expressing himself, entirely shorn of pretension, was far removed from the typical discourse of professional intellectuals, and partly because the world saw him primarily as a dashing man of action who looked perfectly at home in a not conspicuously literary family. The wide range of his interests may also have suggested a dilettante, but in fact he thought deeply as well as reading widely. Clearly the Duke read everything he could get his hands on about the subjects he was most interested in, and in many cases added his own volume to the shelves. His own contribution to his library's groaning ornithology section, for example, was Birds from Britannia 1962, an account of how he came to fall in love with wild birds during his famous round-the-world trip on the Royal Yacht Britannia in 1956 to 1957. Before that voyage, he wrote, "My ignorance of birds was sublime. If pressed, I would have admitted that apart from the more obvious game birds, and the others came in three categories, sparrows, seagulls and ducks. The book was illustrated with his own photographs. One of his biographers, Dennis Judd, reported that his favourite photograph from the book, and one which illustrates his particular brand of humour, was placed on the inside of a lavatory door at Sandringham, showing a bird squatting low with an expression of great strain. It was his work on this project that kindled his interest in conservation. It's only a matter of a short time of bird watching and photography before the question of survival of species begins to dawn on the mind, he wrote. His next major book, Wildlife Crisis, in 1970, was a collaboration with the naturalist and broadcaster James Fisher. The Duke admitted in the book that his interest in the natural world had come relatively late in life. He wrote that he had no interest in bug hunting in his youth, but this apology for the then unfashionable cause of wildlife conservation is written with the zeal of a convert. Unsurprisingly, for a man who calculated to have delivered 5,493 speeches by the time he retired, many of his books were collections of his speeches and lectures. A volume such as Men, Machines and Sacred Cows, 1984, reminds us that his royal status never impeded him from expressing controversial opinions. Although he had voiced criticisms of specific people, those who get it in the neck as class include politicians. I have no sympathy with people who claim to know what is good for others. The clergy, almost without exception, they preach peace, goodwill and the brotherhood of man, and yet many of them have been used by the unscrupulous to cause more human conflict and misery than any other system, save perhaps communism. And polo umpires? Mutton-headed dolts totally ignorant of the simplest rules of the game. There are further reflections on conservation, but the Duke also conveys his scorn for those who think that championing of technological progress is incompatible with environmentalism. One piece takes the Swiftian form of an ironic plea to ban helicopters. If I can persuade you to join me in this campaign, the disappearance of the helicopter is assured, and then we shall all be able to hold our heads high as we march steadily back towards the caves our ancestors so foolishly vacated such a long time ago. This is a genuine epigrammatic wit to his writing. I am interested in leisure in the same way that a poor man is interested in money. I can't get enough of it. And he writes eloquently about the importance of using humour in the discussion of serious issues, even if it doesn't always pay off. Trying to be funny is a great deal more difficult than trying to be serious. What may strike me as a witty comment can easily turn out to be painfully tactless. Those who enjoy the Duke in his porkier vein may want to try his memoirs of carriage driving, such as 30 Years On and Off the Seat, 2004. The title says it all, and many publishers have produced unofficial collections of his gaffes and quips for upmarket latrinal reading. But to get to the heart of what Prince Philip really thought and believed, one should seek out three books that he published in the 1980s, which attempt to marry his spiritual and philosophical views. The first is A Question of Balance, 1982, a collection of essays edited by the Dean of Windsor, Michael Mann, and about how to live a fulfilling life. It begins with a denunciation of Marx and his predilection for totalitarian solutions, and advocates a sort of spiritual individualism. Religious conviction is the strongest and probably the only factor in sustaining the dignity and integrity of the individual, he concludes. Perhaps the most annoying thing about the television drama The Crown is not its ludicrous depictions of Philip being blackmailed by Anthony Blunt or threatening Diana, but the fact that it ignores the introspective side of him. You wouldn't know from the series that he ever picked up a book in his life, much less wrote several. This was a man as stimulated by new ideas as he was sailing, riding and shooting. Not a mere busybody, but somebody who thought carefully and intelligently about life. He had much in common with his predecessor as royal consort, Prince Albert, another foreigner with a rather un-English interest in ideas and a keenness for reform. And one wonders how different the UK might be today if Philip had had a comparable level of power and influence. But being a 20th century royal, he could only lobby rather than guide policy, And so, like any old commoner, he had to learn how to argue a case cogently and eloquently. Perhaps, as his knockabout public persona fades from view, Prince Philip, the writer and thinker, will come to be more widely appreciated. One hopes that some of his books might even be republished. In the meantime, we might remember him by reading a contribution he made to a book of prayers in 1998. It distills in a few words much of what he thought about the triangular relationship between man, God, and the natural world. A little glimpse into what was whirring away in his private mind of this most public of figures. O Lord, the creator of the universe and author of the laws of nature, inspire in us, thy servants, the will to ensure the survival of all species of animals and plants which you have given to share this planet with us. Help us to understand that we have a responsibility for them, and that having dominion does not mean that you have given us the right to exploit the living world without thought for consequences. Through him who taught us that Solomon could not compare with the beauty of the flowers of the field. What an excellent tribute to the man. Far, far deeper than we know. I will certainly be looking into some of these books. I do hope you enjoyed that review.